Susan Ashbaker. I'm an artistic advisor and vocal coach, and have worked with singers at various stages in their careers. My work helps them focus on developing a comprehensive approach to the key elements that will support advancing and building a singer's career. Joining me today to discuss their own career-building experiences are two young singers who were finalists in the 2007 Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions, sopranos Kira Duffy and Dísela Laurosdóttir. I've also invited their teacher, Laura Brooks Rice, a former Met winner herself and co-founder of Westminster's Cooperative Program for Young Singers, to join us. Kira, Dísela, and Laura, welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to set the stage for a moment. You're in one of the largest opera theaters. It's a packed house. You can feel the energy and the excitement. You walk out on the stage to sing. You are a Metropolitan Opera Competition finalist. What does it feel like?
Oh gosh, I get afraid just when I hear those words again. The description. It was wonderful. I mean, I don't know how to describe it. It was just phenomenal. I tried to not think about what you just described for us right there, because this is just another stage, you know, and just keep myself grounded, mm-hmm. because this was just so overwhelming and wonderful that it was a little bit almost too good to be true.
Yeah, I would echo that. It was pretty incredible. Breathtaking. You can hear Margaret Juntwaite say on the broadcast that she saw me physically go, whoa.
Well, what people can't see right now is the incredible smile that both of these ladies have and the excitement that's still in their eyes, even though the competition has passed. What was the first thing that you thought about when you walked onto the Met stage?
Honestly, for me, it was rock and roll, baby. I mean, I had to kind of put it in that vernacular. I just wanted to enjoy myself. Actually, I was the opener on the concert, and I was waiting backstage. Before Stephanie Blythe went on, who was the mistress of ceremonies, she had said to me, "Now, when you go out on that stage, I want you to take a minute and take it all in, because it could so easily pass you by." And I thought that was so incredible to hear. It kind of reminded me of people talking about their weddings and how, you know, it flies by in a minute and they wish they had been more present. So for me, when I went out there, I really did make a point to just inhale the excitement and the breathlessness of the experience.
Wow. Dísela, what about you?
Oh, my answer is not so sophisticated. It was kind of just, okay, keep your breath and, you know, just know what you're doing. And I was trying to tell myself, you belong here, just to get the nerves out of the way. Because, mm-hmm. like I said before, it was just so unbelievable. I mean, we've all gone to the Met before, and I've imagined myself standing on that stage. When you're in the audience, you can look at the stage and you can go, yeah, I can do that, you know, no problem. But when you're actually standing there, it's a totally different thing.
Yeah. So the other thing, when you just said, you belong here, a lot of people thought both of you belonged there, because you made it past the district level, you made it past the regional level, you made it past the semifinal level. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people listening to you saying, you belong here. I'm glad that you both had such positive reactions to that. Mm-hmm. I know from working with singers that too often singers think, oh shoot, if I'd only held this note for a half a second more, and you tend to be hypercritical. I want to forget about that. I want to ask you, what were you most proud of with your singing that day?
That's a tough question.
That was a really special day for me for a lot of reasons. I'm not shy about saying that I'm a singer who's grappled with, you know, her share of performance anxiety. And that day I felt so confident. And one of the other things I said to myself before I went on stage was, go out there. Yes, I said rock and roll, but take risks. And I really felt in that, however long it was, 5 minutes or so, I took every risk I could, dramatically, vocally. And I can remember there was a specific moment in the first half of the Karanome where things went a little awry vocally. I had a little glitch. And I, in the past, may have been derided by that. But the thing that I was so proud of is I can remember this so specifically. I was so in the moment that it did not distract me at all. I went right back into healthy, good vocalism, being in the moment dramatically. And for me, that was a huge accomplishment personally.
Excellent.
I don't know if I should talk about that. I'm not excusing myself, but I wasn't feeling my best that day. I guess I was very proud of being able to, even though I wasn't in my best shape, to be able to still sing and do what I have learned. That's another thing. What was going through my mind while I was singing is breathe, breathe, you know, and I could hear Miss Rice. She was there with me, whispering in my ear, just breathe, there's a lasso. I'm proud of that. I know now that I can do more than I might maybe believe sometimes.
Right.
So,
oh, Laura, I loved the fact that she heard your voice saying, you can do it, in her head. You've had singers sing at the Met before.
Yes.
I don't know that I've ever recalled that two singers in the finals were from the same teacher. And I think that's a pretty remarkable statistic there. How did it make you feel to be in the Met, listening to not one student, but two students in the finals?
Well, I was incredibly proud, of course. And it was recalled that when I was a winner in 81, there was another one of my studio mates, so I know that my teacher, Margaret Harshaw, had the same luck, if you want to call it that. But this is the first time that I've seen two young singers that I've worked with for so long reach this high achievement. And it was just wonderful because I know what they were going through because I went through the same thing 20-something years ago. And it's true. I was absolutely with you every step of the way because I knew that you weren't 100%. I didn't know from you. I knew from what I heard. I was really speaking to you. And when Kira walked out, I just was in a puddle of tears. She was the first one out. And I was sitting with a friend of hers, and we both just, we lost it. Because it's just a wonderful accomplishment for all of us, but mostly for these two young ladies.
During the actual performance, did you have audience ears on or teacher ears on?
You know, I think a little of both, but mostly teacher ears. I wish I could turn them off. Mm-hmm. Not just when I'm hearing my own students, when I'm hearing anybody. But no, I was definitely there being their most voracious cheerleader. And you know, as I know with my own students when I can trust them. Mm-hmm. And I can trust these girls and know that they know what they're doing. We had very little contact that week. In fact, none.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We text messaged here and there, and I think I probably drove them nuts the day of because I was going crazy myself, wondering where are they, what are they doing, when are they rehearsing, when are they getting dressed?
So let's talk about that week a little bit. When you were there working with the people at the Met, what did you do? Were there rehearsals? With whom did you work? Explain a little bit so we can be there with you.
Right after the semifinals, that was on a Sunday, right on the Monday we had to come and meet with Marco Armiliato, which was the conductor. Help me out here, Kira.
Well, it's a very intense week. They, on paper, it doesn't look so bad. You have maybe a coaching a day, and then maybe you have a meeting with Gaylitha Nichols, who's the director of the National Council Auditions, to discuss career things. It doesn't look that overwhelming, but actually when you're going through it, it's an incredibly intensive week because, as Gisela said, I mean, you get no break. After the semifinals, you're absolutely depleted of all energy, and then you have to go in and sing not just for your teacher, but for Marco Armiliato. What I mean by sing for our teacher is that it feels a lot safer than having to sing for a Metropolitan Opera maestro. So you have that, and then you have breathing class, and you have dramatic coachings with Gina Lipinski, and you have your meetings with Gaylitha Nichols, and they're shooting this documentary as well that's going to be nationally released. And so the whole time you have a camera lens and a microphone floating in front of your face, which just kind of adds to the whole intensity of the week. So at least I found myself experiencing this. By the time you get to that following Sunday, the day of the concert,
you're just ready to do it.
Yeah.
You're sick of rehearsing. You just want to get on that stage and do your thing and also kind of resume a quasi-normal life.
Yeah.
And all the singers kept saying, it's like Disney World for singers. You know, you're like, you're walking in the hall and, oh, there's David Daniels, or there's Natalie Dissett, Barbara Friedley in the cafe, you know, it's kind of overwhelming.
How was the repertoire chosen for the finals? You both mentioned a little bit about that.
You sing on the following Monday, you sing the two arias that you did not present in the semifinals, because for the semifinals and finals, you only have four arias, not five, which is more typical. You sing those two, and it's actually a very collaborative experience.
They kind of asked, what are you most comfortable with, mm-hmm. and then what would sound best. They were very nice mm-hmm. in allowing us to show something that was very contrasting, mm-hmm. to enable for us to show mm-hmm. everything we can do. Pretty much.
Was the Monday rehearsal on the stage in a large rehearsal room or in a practice studio or a coaching studio?
It was a large practice studio, I mm-hmm. guess. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to segue now to a sound clip that we have of Dissola singing Bellini's O Quante Volte from I Capuleti e Montecchi.
Okay.
Some elegant phrasing there, Dissola.
Thank you.
I'd like to take you back a little bit in time and talk about your journey to the finals.
Mm-hmm.
Both of you were students at Westminster. And I'd like to know, when you think back, how was Westminster helpful in preparing you for your performance career and your success?
In every way helpful, I would say. I don't know where to start, actually. Personally, when I first came to Westminster, I wasn't much of an opera singer. I was an extreme newcomer, and I knew I wanted to sing. I knew I wanted to sing classical. But when it came to technique, thanks to Miss Rice, I am where I am today, technically, because I did not have that. So first of all, that everything else, the pedagogy, all the literature classes, everything just helped develop us as full musicians, not just, quote-unquote, just the singer. There's more to it, of course. I absolutely think that in every way, Westminster puts his arms around you and makes sure that you get all the education that you need, I think.
I love the image of the arms around you.
I talk with my hands a lot.
I would echo everything that Dissola said. I had the great fortune of doing both of my degrees at Westminster, and I've studied with Miss Rice. This will be the completion of my 10th year with her. In fact, it becomes increasingly more apparent how lucky I was to have had her mm-hmm. as a technician. So, pragmatically speaking, we were given all of the wonderful classes, all the coursework you could expect from any conservatory. But beyond that, I think what's specific to Westminster is that enveloping feeling, the warm, fuzzy feeling, if you will. Mm-hmm. There's a real philosophy of giving through music and doing music in a way that is devoid of self and of ego. And I think that informs me every day as a solo singer.
Mm, that's lovely. Clearly, I hear from both of you that the influence of your teacher is truly paramount. Thinking of all the classes that you took, was there any class in particular that really stands out as being something that was very helpful, either because of what it taught you to do or what it showed you need more of?
I would say opera audition mm-hmm. class really opened my eyes that what you need to do in auditions. I mean, you don't just walk in and sing. You have to prepare. How are you going to look? How are you going to present yourself? Can you talk, or do you wait until they ask you what's your name or mm-hmm. everything like that? And so those were extremely helpful. Also, the pedagogy, just to realize what you need to do to take care of your instrument.
Mm-hmm. I was already gone by the time Miss Rice had formed the specific auditions techniques class, but still the performance classes that she gave when I was there, at one point it was called Intro to Opera, Singing Actor Opera. I took the class twice, and that was invaluable, of course. Mm-hmm, yeah. Then I would second the pedagogy classes in terms of vocal health and vocal maintenance, and the language and diction courses are very pragmatic skills that I use every day.
Mm-hmm. Are there any study habits that you began while you were a student that are invaluable to you to this day that you really can count on?
Certainly the role study that I acquired in that very first introduction to opera class that I took when I was a sophomore in college. You know, who are you? How old are you? Where are you? What are the relationships that you have with the other characters in the opera? What are they saying to you? Those kinds of skills, again, they're very pragmatic skills, but they're absolute necessities mm-hmm. in the day-to-day preparation that I use when I'm learning a role.
When you were students here, did you sing in any of the choirs?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've done almost every choir there is uh-huh. here.
Did the choral singing that you did here at Westminster inform your vocal career in any way?
I am like the big cheerleader of how a choral education can absolutely affect a solo singer positively. I came to Westminster not wanting to be a solo singer. I wanted to be a choral conductor. Of course, serendipity has had it that I've taken a different path, but the experiences that I had as a chorister directly influenced me every day. Speaking on two levels, I'll start with more practical levels. Just when you're in the symphonic choir at Westminster, you're singing on the stage of the New York Philharmonic or the Philadelphia Orchestra or the New Jersey Symphony. And from the time I was 18 till I was 23, I had sung on the same stage as soloists like Anthony Dean Griffey, Peter Schreier, Heidi Grant Murphy, Paul Groves, Renee Fleming. Having the opportunity to observe these great singers in rehearsal and in performance, to see the real nuts and bolts of what they do on the stage, of course, is without comparison. And then there's the more philosophical level. Both Diesel and I were members of what I guess you can now call the Flummerfelt era. And for me, Joe Flummerfelt absolutely taught me some of the most fundamental reasons for music making. And I got that in the choral experience, both in symphonic choir and in the Westminster choir. Again, making music is about connection. He uses this word source all the time, have a connection with source. And I think that can be translated into making music in a way that is honest and, again, devoid of the self in the best sense. And those are things that I think have helped me distinguish myself in this extremely competitive solo singing arena.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask a question just to clarify. You say Joe was helpful in having you go to source, which becomes devoid of self and really lets the music speak mm-hmm. on its own. Yet part of solo singing is about putting your own stamp, yeah, exactly. yourself on that.
Yes.
How does that reconcile in a career?
The common denominator in what you're talking about is what my friend Joe Flummer felt always required of you was to go to an honest place. Uh-huh. And that's the same thing I asked of you mm-hmm. in singing actor, and that an honest performance is going to reach an audience quicker than anything else. And that's what you all did in your music making in choir and in your solo music making. And is that the work that you did, the research you did, helped you reach an honest conclusion mm-hmm. instead of yeah. putting a character on or yes. assuming a character? You funneled it through you.
Yes.
Right, yeah.
We've referenced both the auditions class mm-hmm. and the singing actor class. Can you tell us a little bit about these classes and what your goal is when you teach them?
Sure. Well, you've been very instrumental in encouraging me to create a class like the graduate auditions class. Both of these ladies have had a chance to sing for administrators at the Met, Opera Company of Philadelphia, Opera Theater St. Louis. I've brought in Kim Whitman from Wolf Trap Opera, and the list goes on and on, where a group of graduate students does a mock audition for these visitors. And it's been terrific for me as their teacher to gain that perspective again. I'm not out there auditioning anymore, and thank God. And it's very different from when I was doing it. And so the only way I can gain perspective on what they must have is to bring people in and let them hear them and critique them. And you've been great in being very honest with me about our students and what they need, and I've done what I could to give them the opportunity. The other class, the singing actor opera, I love that class. It's for both undergraduate and graduate students. And I tell them at the beginning of the class that we're not working on a product, we're working on a process of how to find a character, how to love this art form, how to listen to it effectively, and how to assimilate all the skills that you've learned so far in music theory and music history and in your voice lessons and in your literature classes, and how you can pull all of that stuff together. That is what I think is one of the hardest things singers have to do, is to assimilate all the skills that they've learned. You know, they separate them all out, and then they have to pull them all together. Mm-hmm. And I love seeing the light bulbs go off when they know they can trust their vocal technique, when they know a lot that they can bring to their performance. They don't have to be told. I've seen both of these ladies grow through those experiences and through singing for people like you and listening undefensively to what the comments have been about their singing and about their presentation and then how we can work on it.
This is a good time also to ask, there's more to life than opera. Although opera is the prominent venue for a solo singer, there's still oratorio and art song. Mm-hmm. Is there a class or a situation that addresses that at Westminster?
Yes, they have a repertoire class that's usually been taught by the wonderful accompanist J.J. Penna, where they get to explore all types of song repertoire, lieder. There are classes on oratorio literature, but being that we are the choir college, there is some kind of concert happening every week with graduate students conducting majors, mm-hmm. wanting soloists, and so there are opportunities, certainly through the symphonic repertoire, for them to learn repertoire and then know this is what I might be able to sing as a soloist, and then to try things out in graduate student recitals. And also in their curriculum, in their lessons and in their juries, they're required to have a certain amount of languages. And I usually try to balance out opera with enough art song repertoire and oratorio repertoire, so it's not just a steady diet of opera. I think the art song repertoire with the attention to language and communicating through sound and through nuance affects their operatic singing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they have to go back and forth and find that love of language.
Mm-hmm. I've often referred to art song, certainly depending upon which art song, as vegetables for the voice. It's something that's really, really healthy for you. This is a good place to slip in another excerpt, this time by Kira, from Carmina Burana, which is composed by Carl Orff. And I loved when Kira was telling me which excerpt it was, because she had two ways of pronouncing it. So tell us the two ways and why they're different.
Oh, well, it just depends on if they're doing the German Latin or the Italian Latin. It's either dolcissime with a ch or dolcissime, and I can't remember which one I used. So.
Well, we'll hear.
We'll find out.
Thank you.
Well, before we leave Westminster, I wanted to ask, do one of the three of you have any words of wisdom for the current students at Westminster?
I would say the most important thing for me has been to be honest with myself and to surround myself with people whom I trust to be honest with me. That is something that consistently affects me on a daily basis. You're constantly reevaluating what you do that is special. At this point in my career, when you're a student, of course, you're considering, do I have what it takes to do this career? Do I really want this career? And again, that requires constant questioning, constant evaluating, and I cannot stress enough the importance of surrounding yourself with people whom you trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. I would also say, after you figured that out, I could not emphasize this enough, to just keep your focus where it needs to belong. Especially, I mean, I only took my graduate there, and they keep you busy, let's just say that. It's very easy to get distracted. I'm glad I didn't, but I can see how people could get distracted because you have to do so many things. I also almost felt like there was not time to even practice because there were so many essays and so many books to read. But if you keep your focus, you can still do that. Just really concentrate on keeping your focus and hold on to what you actually want.
And I'd like to hear also from the master teacher herself.
Mm-hmm. My current students will not find this surprising, but I do learn this from these girls and other alumni who are out there making quite successful careers. And they all say, take advantage of what you have while you have it right now. Mm-hmm. That you have a practice room you don't have to pay for. You have a voice teacher that you can find easily. You have a library. You have a listening library. You know, take advantage of all those things and also keep your options open.
Yes.
You know, take advantage of every opportunity. Yes, stay focused, but keep your options open. I was in the same place these ladies are. And I got asked to teach 23 years ago. It's the best decision I ever made. Mm. You know, I was on the fast track to I'm going to sing. And I did sing. But I'm glad that I took a step in this direction. Yeah. So I always tell my students, just you don't know who you're sitting next to and who they're going to be in 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it's a good reason to always be a good colleague and to also keep your options open.
Yeah. Well, I liked what you said about take advantage of what you have while you have it. You know, you step outside of school and you start paying anywhere from $100 to $300 for a voice lesson.
Sure.
And $50 to $150 for a coaching.
Mm-hmm.
And the same amount of money for addiction coaching. And then the same amount of money for an acting coaching. And I think if a student were to count up the number of classes that they've had or the lessons and coachings that they've had, they would realize what a bargain they've gotten for the time that they've been in school, because it's very, very expensive. And try having a day job to simply survive unless you've got very, very wealthy underwriters. You're going to be working a lot. I wanted to go back to something that Diesla said when she said, sometimes it got to the point where I couldn't even practice. How many hours a day do you practice now when you work on your music?
Well, at least an hour a day, I would say.
Now, when you say an hour a day, is that an hour total or is that an hour of vocal work?
It depends, I guess, on the day, but hour total, at least. It really depends on the day, I would say.
Uh-huh.
Because sometimes you're in great vocal health and sometimes you're not so great. And, you know, and sometimes it takes you forever to just warm up. And sometimes it's right there when you wake up. So it just depends on the day. But I do try to vocalize every single day, just to have it, just to know where it is and just to know my voice better.
I would say for me too, it's very hard to quantify practice time, and to a certain degree it's always been, because there are so many variables with the voice. But again, that comes back to how you define practice. If you define practice only by singing, there are days when maybe I only practice 15 minutes if I'm feeling not so great vocally. But I couldn't even begin to count up the number of hours. If I consider practice, role study, translation.
Yeah.
And for me now, more than anything, I think the mental practice that I do is extremely important. You get to a certain level with your voice where, because we have been given such a fantastic technical foundation, where you know, of course, you have to vocalize
most days out of the week, you have to be practicing using the musculature, but so much of the next step in this career relies upon your mental game, so to speak. And that's, as I referenced earlier, particularly pertinent with me, that I have to be feeling mentally resilient and mentally focused. So at this stage in my career, I consider my practice to consist of a lot of meditation, a lot of vocalism combined with my mental state when I'm doing that practice. Mm-hmm. So much of it is not quantity, but it's quality. Mm-hmm. You can stand in a room for half an hour and sing scales and be thinking about your grocery shopping and have accomplished nothing. But I find if I use 15 minutes where I'm really thinking about the production of my sound, and not just the production of the sound, but the confidence I feel when I'm making that sound, that's much more valuable.
Well, it's interesting because when I look at practice, I don't look at just the actual, for me, hands on the keyboard time, because so much of what we do is brain work. You have to study, whether it's score study or language study or character study. And so when Diesel said, oh, I practice an hour a day, my eyes got big because I thought, oh my goodness, that's not enough time. It's plenty of time for the vocal parts if that's what you're doing. But you probably spend anywhere from 3 to 8 hours a day dealing with a global practice. And if we think about an athlete, they practice a scrimmage, count the whole thing, the stretching. It's all part of the process. So each moment that you're focused on something is practice.
This is something that I try to teach all of my students, and both Kira and Diesel know this, that I ask them to practice at least 4 times a day for 15 minutes and to spread the vocalism, as Kira described it, the concentrating on the production of sound in short practice session, so that if it's fabulous, they come back in an hour and a half and they repeat the sensation. Or if it's terrible, they come back and it's a little bit better, and then they come back. It also lessens frustration, hopefully. And this is separate from working on repertoire, but and this is what great athletes do. I remember an interview with Jack Nicklaus, the great golfer, who would shake his head watching young golfers just mindlessly hit golf balls on the driving range, and he would go out and take a piece of his game and focus on it for 15 minutes and leave the course, then come back to the tournament. So it's there's something that builds muscle memory, and it lessens mental strain. And
well, I will encourage singers in a coaching to take this measure and work on it for 3 minutes. Because if you think, oh, this is my 2-hour practice block, if you're tired, you're not going to use it well, but you can find 3 minutes throughout your day to practice a specific thing, and that can be so helpful. I want to go back to something, Kira, that you said. You talked about your voice, and then you said the voice. It may seem odd, but people refer to their voice as either my voice or the voice, as if it's a separate person or identity.
God, so obnoxious.
How do you view your voice or the voice?
I hate those singers. Well, the voice is feeling all right today, and I just didn't. My voice is pretty delicate, if I'm speaking completely candidly. I mean, I know that there are, most of us have heard about these singers who have cords of steel, and I know some of those people. It's like they can smoke a pack of cigarettes and somehow sound pretty darn good the next day.
They're all basses.
Yeah, they're all basses. I hate them. No, I think for me, I have to be very vigilant about pacing myself. I find, in general, high sopranos tend to just have a more delicate physiognomy than other voice types. I don't want to overgeneralize, but I know with my voice, the voice, it fatigues fairly easily. And when I'm feeling fatigued, because I'm that personality type that likes to push through, sometimes in the past, not so much anymore, in my naivete, I would just continue to sing on it and then be fried for 3 days afterwards. Like, Miss Rice, I'm sorry, I can't have a lesson. But I think the pedagogy class has helped a lot with recognizing misuse, overuse, and abuse. And when you have a career, when you're traveling all the time, when you're on airplanes and changing time zones, it becomes ever more necessary that you are in touch with your voice and you know what your personal body needs in order to produce at its optimal level.
Absolutely. I'm the same way. I am so fragile. It's so annoying at times.
It's so annoying.
I need my sleep. I need a lot of sleep. I need a lot of water. I need to take my vitamins, It's a lot of work to maintain good vocal health. I mean, it just is.
Well, your body is your instrument. Mm-hmm. I have a piano. I'm stuck with whatever is in the room. If it's a great Steinway, I am thrilled. If it's a bad upright that hasn't been tuned, that's the only instrument I have. Yeah. You carry your bodies with you. And so you're a vocal athlete, and everything you do informs your voice or the voice.
Well, and it also is just another case, yet another case for forming the best technique that you can develop, because as Cecil said, you are going, of course we all want to have optimal voice days, but you cannot control all the variables that come in to play when you are a professional traveling singer. Mm-hmm. And that is why you have a technique, so that you can come back to these basic fundamentals of voice production and know that when you're feeling like a B minus, you can fool everybody in the room and sound pretty darn good.
And simple things like you'd go into an audition, you have to take the train, there's a lot of people, maybe three people around you are sneezing and coughing. Stuff like that that you need to think about that normal person possibly wouldn't even consider.
Right.
But you have to go home and take airborne.
I used to tell them a quote that my teacher said all the time is that you won't feel like singing 80% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that 20% we live for.
Yeah. Right.
But that 80% is when you really have to think about singing. And that's not always fun, but it is why you have to have a reliable technique that will help you get through those days that you might not wake up 100%. It doesn't have anything to do with your voice.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I've often said to singers, there'll be 3 or 4 days in your whole life where everything will align and it will be perfect for singing, and you won't have a job that day.
Yeah.
And the other times you have to rely totally on your technique and what you know.
That's the truth.
Yep. So, staying on the topic of auditions, one of the sad truths for all singers until you become Renee Fleming is that you do have to audition time and time and time again. And you will have sung hundreds of auditions by the time you don't have to audition anymore. Do you usually get nervous for auditions? Why? Why not? And do you have a routine for dealing with that?
I usually always get a little nervous. And every time I tell myself that, that's just healthy. Because it is. It gives you a little bit of an adrenaline, and this is what we're here for. I'm dealing with it a lot better today. I don't notice it as much as I probably. I was probably way more actually nervous for those opera audition classes, or that we did at school, which I actually wish we were doing again now, because it's just so much harder now. I am a very religious person. I just talked to my dad, and who passed away in 2000. And I believe that he's by my side, and then all is good.
That's lovely. That's a wonderful tribute to your relationship with your dad and how to keep him with you.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah.
There are a lot of superstitions and different regimens that singers have for dealing with things. And some people always wear this one particular pair of shoes because they're the lucky shoes. Or if they sing, they have a particular picture that they look at right before they go out on stage. Do you have any superstitions or things like that you do that hook into?
I am so prone to that kind of, if you want to say nonsense. Maybe not nonsense, I don't know. But I'm so prone to do stuff like that I am very diligent in telling myself that I do not need anything like that.
Good for you.
Because I would freak out if I would have a certain habit, and then I wouldn't be able to do it for some reason. I do have a rock that, again, my father gave to me. He engraved my name in it. Sometimes when I'm practice, I rub it just to get, concentration. If I would always take that rock with me and then one day forget it, I would absolutely freak out. So I try to stay away from those.
Laura, you're having an expression on your face.
Well, it's another family thing. It's my mother, who passed away a couple of years ago, always carried a Buckeye in her purse for luck. And when she passed away and I cleaned out her room, the drawers were filled with them. All of her purses were filled with them. I had one with me when I won the Met auditions. Mm. Something else that I learned from my friend Jamie Schmidt, who teaches at Westminster, and how to help the students get physically prepared, mentally prepared, yes, but to find the right physical energy and physical balance it's been important for me to realize that what works for me doesn't necessarily work for my students. For me, some of the best auditions I've ever done or performances are when I'm late. I need to get myself revved up. Mm-hmm. Whereas somebody like Kira lives there. She needs to find more grounding. And then, you know, but anyway, it's been a lovely journey for me to know what my individual students need and to try to, to help them identify that.
Yeah. Well, I recommend to singers that they keep an audition journal. And the audition journal details the who, what, when, where, and why of the audition. I woke up at 7, took the train in, it was really crowded and it was late and I was stressed. I auditioned in this hall, I'd never auditioned there before, and it was carpeted and I felt, detail everything, because this way you can memorialize what works for you and what doesn't, from your warming up experience to the audition space to the clothing to the pianist. Because there are times when you walk into an audition and that you find out who the pianist is and you are so thrilled.
Yeah.
Because you know that this is somebody who's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Or you know that the space is really generous to your voice. Or you know that there's no warm-up room. And this can eliminate some of the unknowns. And I also remind singers that the success of an audition is not dependent upon getting the job or winning the prize. Because if you audition for 100 things, you may get one job.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you're not phenomenal. And, you know, when we look at buying a car, we don't say, I only like this kind of car because they're the only valuable car. We have a lot of different things, price range, color, size, city traffic versus not city traffic. And you're not emotionally attached to your Buick.
Yeah.
And yet singers are like, why didn't they like me?
Yeah.
And there were so many times when I was in the position of casting that I would love someone so much and have nothing for them.
Yeah.
And I would usually reach out to that person or their agent and say, you had a phenomenal audition, I have nothing for you, but I didn't want you walking away thinking you were totally bombing the situation. But the reality is, there are more singers than jobs. So, with that in mind, are there any recommendations or advice that you can give for other singers? And I'd love to hear one thing from each of you as they get ready to audition.
As they get ready to audition for
anything
that they should be absolutely secure with all of their repertoire, secure vocally, secure linguistically, they have something to say, if they've tried it in different venues.
The other thing is, and this might be controversial, not everyone will agree with me, but personally, I think not all auditions are created equal. You need to know for whom you're singing, for what company you're singing, with what Miss Rice has said in mind. There are certain auditions where you could perhaps try out an aria that you have not done before, but that better not be your audition for Houston Grand Opera's studio program.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe if it's a small house and you're auditioning for an outreach program or something small where you feel safe, you could try it. But again, that comes back to knowing where you stand, surrounding yourself with the people who are honest with you.
Once again, what I've learned from you and from our other colleagues that have come to campus or through my work with Opera America, and I'm beginning to hear what people don't want to hear in an audition.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to focus their repertoire so that they can be hired right now, that they're not presenting repertoire that shows people what they can't do right now.
Yeah.
It shows them what they're able to do and where they're castable, or what might lead to something else, or they might want to be recommended for something. So really knowing who they are vocally and physically and where they can be used immediately, I think is the best advice that
I've gotten
from the field.
Yeah. I have two other things. One is only sing healthfully and only sing when you are healthy. If you're really sick and sneezing through it, you're never going to be your best self. The other thing is make sure you not only have something to say, but that you have something with which to say it. Too often I'll hear someone with a beautiful sound, beautiful technique, and they have nothing to say musically.
Mm-hmm.
Or they have all sorts of things to say and a very flawed voice. Mm-hmm. And it's only when the two are married does it really merge. Now, Laura, you're co-founder with Chris Arneson of the Cooperative Program, which Westminster hosts each summer. This is our second year.
Yes.
So you hear a number of auditions, too. Are there any pitfalls or big mistakes that you hear singers make that you'd like to, or make best impressions, either way?
I can hear now what you all have been going through for so many years, and that when somebody presents themselves, it's usually in repertoire that's one fach too heavy. Mm. And it shows us, once again, what they can't do. Whereas you hear a young singer who is singing repertoire that is age-appropriate, that shows us what they can do, and they can truly shine. Chris and I created this program based on the feedback I was getting from my students who were going out and auditioning, and they would come back to their voice teacher and say, so-and-so said, I've really got to work on my languages. I need to work on my presentation. I need to work on honing my repertoire and really being coached. And so, and then it comes back to the voice teacher, which in 1 hour, yeah. You know, and not only that, I'm not equipped to take care of all of their needs. So we created a 3-week program where they can come to Princeton and have 2 to 3 coachings, sometimes 3 to 4 coachings a day with the likes of you and Yelena Cordina from the Met, Daniel Beckwith, Ted Taylor, you know, wonderful coaches, all based on the campus where they would be paying $100 to $200 in New York or Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. They're all on our campus for 3 weeks mm-hmm. where they can go from one building to another with half-hour coachings. And it's all geared to help them solidify their audition package and feel more confident with auditions. And Diesela was one of our first members, and I would love to know how that experience
exactly.
helped you.
I was just about to say, I wanted to add in there that I did this last summer, and I could not recommend this program more. It's amazing, and I learned so much from all those coaches, and it's so good because it's 3 weeks, it's really compact. You have to sing sometimes 4 hours during the day, and it's all intense. You're concentrating the whole time. In between, it's not just those 4 hours. You have to go over your language. What are you saying? La, 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 la. So many things coming from all directions. It's just an amazing program. And for me, that helped me a lot to prepare myself for the Met this year. That's really
We're
amazing.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah.
I have a few other questions that I'm going to ask, this time specifically to various people. Diesela, I happen to know that there is a direct result opportunity that happened for you since being a finalist at the Met. Would you like to share that with us?
Yes, I was approached and they asked me to cover a role of Miss Schlesen in Satyagraha by Philip Glass.
At the Metropolitan Opera.
At the Metropolitan Opera,
yes. Excellent, congratulations.
Thank you.
Kira, impressions count. You sang with the Opera Company of Philadelphia in Cenerentola this past season, and have been offered and accepted 2 subsequent roles, one which you can talk about because it's been announced, and one which you can't because my friend at the opera company, Tracy Gallagher, would shoot me if I announce that. But tell us about what a singer can do to leave a great impression and what at least this experience has done for you.
Be prepared. That's like the Girl Scouts say, always be prepared. And when you get there, especially when this is your first time with the company, show that you're eager to learn from the maestro, from the director. Be on time. Be a good colleague. Work hard. For me, that has been huge in getting rehired.
What are a couple of your re-engagements that you can talk about?
Well, with Opera Company of Philadelphia, I'm coming back to do the Dew Fairy in Hansel and Gretel. And this summer is great. I, again, had the fortune of doing the opera What Next by Elliot Carter with James Levine at the podium. This is at the Tanglewood Music Center. Mm-hmm. I'm coming back to do Despina and Così with Maestro Levine, as well as Tebaldo the Page in Don Carlo with the Boston Symphony and Levine at the podium, which I'm really excited about.
Wow. You ladies both have incredible opportunities coming up, and we want to hear a lot more about you and from you in the future. Well, Kira, Diesela, and Laura, thank you for chatting with me this afternoon. Your responses have been not only insightful, but lots and lots of fun. Kira and Diesel, I wish you all the best for a phenomenal career.
Thank you.
Laura, thank you and the other teachers at Westminster for all the support and knowledge you give all of your students. This is Susan Ashbaker. Thank you for joining us for this career conversation at Westminster Choir College of Rider University, where the arts surround your life.